are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 25th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charlie Savage on his book, Power Wars. It's a fascinating interview. How do I know? So I already recorded it. In fact, I already recorded this is too. What I'm saying is recorded. I mean, it's recorded every day, but I'm just saying I'm recording it in advance of the time that you're hearing it, which I guess also happens every day. There's very little difference today between any other day for you folks. Yet, I am en route to Thanksgiving dinner. In fact, you know what? That's a lie. We're in the office, and we are fixing up the set so that when we return from Thanksgiving break, we have a new video set. Will that work out? I don't know. But here's what's happening today. Charlie Savage. For members, you will hear a deep archive show of Bernie Sanders talking about the Patriot Act back in 2005? That is for members. Then tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day, the day that I give Thanksgiving for all the members and all the people who support this program, and even you freeloading listeners, I give thanks to you too. And then I give thanks to New Matt. I give thanks to Classic Kelly and even old Michael. I give thanks to, I can say that, he's not here, which is also sort of weird. And of course, every Thanksgiving, I always give thanks to Kyle for making this show possible from a technical standpoint. And Dorsey and Evan and Hillary and old Matt. And even Meredith's producer, Josh. So, folks, have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy yourselves. Don't listen to those people who tell you don't eat too much. Eat too much. Eat way too much. And then on Friday, we have a members-only show. Nothing for freebies. Go back into the archives if you want. But for members, we're going to hear an interview with Dilip Hero, who wrote the book Iranian Labyrinth. And then also we're going to hear from former Ambassador Joe Wilson on Friday. But more than that, on Friday, for members only, the show will start off with the famed interview that took place in this studio about a month and a half ago, between my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, and David Cross. And she grilled him on his work in Pitch Perfect 2. So for members, you will get to hear that. Someday I will release the video, but it may not be until she's like older. I'm not a big fan of putting my kid on social media, but she came up to me one day and she's like, "Hey, you know David Cross, right?" "Yes." "He's in Pitch Perfect too." "Oh, okay. Can I interview him?" "What do you mean?" "I want to interview him." All right. I'll ask him. And I have to, you know, I mean, if you are familiar with David Cross and his work at all, it would not occur to you that he would be like, oh, sure. But I texted him and he wrote back, oh, sure. I'll be back in like September. And so he came into the studio. Milo sat down with him. Milo wrote up all the questions except for one. And I think he remembers, it becomes clear in the interview that the one that I wrote. And she interviewed him and she asked him some tough questions, put him on the spot at one point. Almost broke news. Almost broke some big news. But so members will enjoy that in addition to the Iranian labyrinth. I mean, it's always a good mix, I think. Having a 10-year-old interview a guy like David Cross juxtaposed with the book on Iran. So like I say, you'll enjoy that. And folks, don't forget the Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa. I don't know. Is Eid coming up? It's the holiday season, ladies and gentlemen. And I know a lot of you are out there looking for a good gift for, well, any man or woman in your life. And I can tell you this, as you know, shaving can be a pain. It can be uncomfortable, cause razor burns, nicks. On top of that, it's also outrageously expensive. Is there anything that you can do that is so uncomfortable that can cost you more money? Like the intersection of those two things, Matt, I know you're thinking of something. Like really, it's probably like dental work. But Harry's.com, for about half the price of other big branded blades, they ship it free to your front door, and they're just simply better, too. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? It's half the price at Harry's. And with Harry's, you get a better shave that shows some respect to your skin, your face, your legs. Wherever you shave, Matt. No more poor quality blades. And this is an amazing deal. The starter set, for $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with the promo code MajorityReport, you can get $5 off that amazing deal if it's your first purchase. Ladies, gentlemen, we all need razors that shave well and don't suck. You know, I've talked about this many times. I don't like to shave. I get a shave actually today because I'm going on to do a hit on MSNBC, which I probably should have mentioned earlier. But the bottom line is, when I shave with a Harry's blade, and it's not as much of a pain. And I know, at least, I haven't spent an arm and a leg. Go to harrys.com, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code MajorityReport with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter the coupon code MajorityReport at checkout for $5 off. Start shaving better today. All right, folks, have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy this interview with Charlie Savage, and we will be back live on Monday. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Charlie Savage, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times and the author of the latest, The Power Wars. Welcome back to the program, Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you know, we spoke, I think it was back in 2011, when you had written an extended essay that I think ultimately you developed into this book. At that time, as we spoke, you were writing about a difference between the Obama administration's running of the national security apparatus and the Bush administration's running of the national security apparatus. And the central, I guess, fulcrum of that book was the process in which they followed. And you've expanded on that in Power Wars. Let's just start, before we get to sort of that aspect, of giving the audience a sort of a broader view on the national security state, which you did in I think it was Takeover, your last best-selling book. Explain to people just sort of how we got to where we are, where there is a lot of moving parts in what creates the national security apparatus.
Okay, well, that's a broad question. Let me maybe lay the groundwork for that by explaining a little bit what this book is, and then that sort of segues into the question you're answering. So how I came to write the book as well. So I've been covering post 9/11 legal and policy issues like Guantanamo and torture and surveillance and drones and secrecy and the like for 12 or 13 years now. And as you're right, I wrote a book about sort of the Bush administration's handling of them, especially through its efforts to expand power at the sort of 7-year mark of the Bush administration. And then I thought in 2009 that when President Obama comes in, and right away after his inauguration, he issues executive orders saying, we're going to close Gitmo, we're going to stop torture, we're going to close the CIA prisons, we're going to have more openness and less secrecy. It kind of seemed like it was all over. And all that stuff that I'd been writing about and was sort of deeply immersed in was turning a corner, and I was going to have to find something else to do with myself. But of course, very quickly, it turned out not to be the case. And so many of these issues rolled on. Gitmo didn't close, and even Obama's plan to close it involved moving the same people to a different prison and holding them without trial there. As we learned from Edward Snowden, Obama kept a very expansive surveillance state that he had inherited. He revived military commissions after temporarily halting them. He expanded the use of drone strikes, even as he moved away from major ground wars in the Middle East. And I eventually came to teach a class on these issues at Georgetown that was sort of organized thematically, Surveillance Week, Detention Week. What do you need to know to be a smart person about these issues that keep resonating and reverberating? And then I decided a couple years ago that this really needed to be a book that draws it all together, that explains why things have turned out the way they have. Why is it that Obama keeps getting accused of acting like Bush? Is that true? What does it mean to act like Bush? Is it true defending way, but not true another way? But also, what are these issues that are pose these continuing dilemmas, and telling lots of behind-the-scenes stories of events happening in the world and people inside the government struggling to understand what they should do or what they can do because so many of the issues faced by the country in 21st century dilemmas of counterterrorism are different than what the dilemmas were envisioned to be when the rules were written for things like war and surveillance. So that's the book. The book explains all this stuff. It divides things up thematically. It's based on 150 interviews, many over and over and over again, interviews with 150 people inside the government, lots of documents that aren't public that I gained access to. And it tries to sort of systematically explain, explore this world, both at the micro level, what's the dispute about Mirandizing terrorists, where did it come from, et cetera, and at the macro level, is Obama acting like Bush? Why do things turn out this way? So you're right. I've been thinking about these things for a long time, even before I started writing this book, and I've had previous stabs at them. When the thing you're talking about in 2011 was a speech I had given at a 10-year anniversary of 9/11 conference at Harvard Law School that I then put out. But this is sort of the culmination now of thinking about these issues for 10 to 13 years, basically making an effort to know everybody on the inside of the government who at the sort of mid to upper reaches that is wrestling with these issues and trying to explain it to an audience of educated but not necessarily trained lawyers why things are the way they are.
I mean, there's so many different sort of, I guess, and that is, you know, I mean, it's a huge book. And I think that's, I mean, you cover so much ground and so many different types of answers to that question of how is how did Obama sort of maintain Bush policies? How did he change them, and why? And let's start around 2009, because You know, one of the things that I recall clearly, and it's obviously in power wars, is this notion of President Obama seeing ultimately, and you talk about sort of going back to the candidate Obama and starting to parse what he's saying and seeing this, that for Obama, a big part of the problem was not necessarily what President Bush was doing, and in fact, certainly not in his second term in the same way, but the way he was going about it, essentially the process that got him to these decisions. Explain that sort of that contrast.
Sure. So when you hear people accusing Obama of acting like Bush because he's using commissions or drones or surveillance and so forth, to try to understand that, and you have to start by unpacking what it means to act like Bush. And what is clearer now than it was during the Bush years was that there were two very different strands of criticism by Democrats and some libertarian-minded conservatives of what the Bush administration was doing after 9/11. There was a rule of law critique and there was a civil liberties critique. And these, for a long time, were lined up together, and sometimes the same people were making both of them, and so it wasn't as clear that these were two different things that were entangled, but they are. So the rule of law critique says the president has to obey the law. He can't say he's the commander-in-chief and just blow through statutes and treaties restricting what he can do, even in war, like FISA, which says you have to get a warrant to wiretap on U.S. soil, for example. And the civil liberties critique says these policies are inherently wrong. The state should not have the power to wiretap someone without going to a judge, regardless of what a statute passed by Congress says. And so Bush is violating civil liberties, Bush is violating the rule of law, but that the difference between the two of those, or one difference, is that the rule of law problem can be fixed. Congress can change federal statutes to bring them into alignment with what the government is doing. And indeed, in Bush's second term, Congress did that with the Military Commissions Act, with the FISA Amendments Act, to name two examples. Federal courts got involved and issued rulings, some of them secret at the time, that also rooted some of the surveillance programs in a claim, at least, that they were authorized by statute and court authority rather than raw presidential power. And so if your focus is on what it means to act like Bush is to violate the rule of law, by 2009, a lot of the problems with the Bush policies had been fixed, and continuing those policies was no longer acting like Bush, because what it means to act like Bush is to violate the rule of law. If your definition of acting like Bush is violating civil liberties, it's all well and good that Congress is now blessing these things, but you don't actually care that much because you think the government should just stop doing those things. And so the Obama so the part two of that analysis is, when you go back and when you look at the people Obama has surrounded himself with, both who they are, which is overwhelmingly lawyers, including in policymaking roles. Of course, Obama himself and Joe Biden are both lawyers. Mm-hmm. And also the people in policymaking roles around them. Obama's two secretaries of state, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, are both lawyers, whereas Bush's were not, and on and on and on. They are overwhelmingly prone, because they're lawyers, to have looked at these issues through the legal authority lens. And indeed, when you go back and look at transcripts and videos of panel discussions and protests and speeches and, you know, op-eds written in the Bush years by those people who went into the Obama administration later in time, what you find is they are overwhelmingly making the rule of law critique and letting other people make the civil liberties critique. So that is why that explains, to some extent, why this administration was willing to keep so many of these tools, because they thought they had a stronger legal basis, and so that was the problem. Now, part of the reason people didn't understand that in the campaign was that Obama, Senator Obama, was running for the Democratic presidential nomination against Senator Hillary Clinton, among others, and they, for the allegiance of a liberal base that was very spun up about Bush and Cheney. And some of them had rule of law complaints, and some of them had civil liberties complaints. Many of them had both. But they didn't want to hear careful parsings of, you know, what Bush did was wrong in 2002, but now it's okay. That wasn't going to win the election.
Right.
And so the candidate Obama, being a politician, spoke expansively, spoke in ways that let any segment of that base think he agreed with them, like any other politician would do, obviously.
Now, with that said, he voted for the FISA amendment, which the amended FISA Act, which sort of retroactively placed this renegade program, if you will, within the context of the law.
That's right, and I treat that as a hugely important moment of foreshadowing. So the important part of that is, number one, when he was still in the Democratic primary, he had promised to filibuster that bill. And then he defeats Hillary Clinton, and he's turning to the general election, and then this bill comes up for a vote, and he votes for it.
Mm.
And he sort of explains, well, here's why I changed my mind and didn't filibuster it after all. But that means he's in favor of a warrantless surveillance program, so long as and thinks it's necessary. And the problem was Bush was violating the law, and now this fixes that problem. And that is sort of a template of what happens after that.
It's also sort of a microcosm in some way, because that law in and of itself also sort of retroactively provided legal justification for actions at the time that were not legal, but particularly providing sort of liability coverage for telephone companies. I mean, so it sort of functions.
I mean, I wouldn't put it quite that way. It didn't make what had happened before legal. It just made the people, the telecoms that had participated in it, not subject to being sued over it.
Okay. But in effect, it has it sort of brings them within at least some auspices, which provides these actions legitimacy.
Well, I guess what you're getting at is Obama is sort of pinioned between criticism on the left and the right. The people on the right, the sort of Dick Cheney caucus, say he's not tough enough on terrorism, and he too much wants to use, you know, civilian trials instead of military commissions and Gitmo and so forth, and shouldn't have ended the torture program. People on the left who are critical of Obama are mad because by continuing most of these programs, that were disputed when Bush created them, in their view at least, is normalizing them. Now, a liberal Democrat president has presided over a government that has a warrantless surveillance program and military commissions and accepts indefinite detention without trial as lawful, even if he's not enthusiastic about using it very often. And a conservative Republican president has obviously presided over those things. And that kind of means that they're no longer subject to political dispute. And so the civil liberties left, I think, feels like that entrenched these policies, and in some ways they feel betrayed by him for having done that.
I mean, putting aside the betrayal aspect of it, but in terms of entrenching, I mean, that seems to me to be sort of an objective analysis. Unless you go back and statutorily unwind these things now, there really doesn't seem to be any type of recourse. I mean, right? I mean, prior to them being ensconced in law and made legal, as it were, there was at least the opportunity of saying this is illegal, and the process, it's both illegal or unconstitutional and illegal, right? I mean, there was no process followed, and the product of that lack of process is also problematic. Now, it is really the only way you reverse something like this is to and particularly now in the wake of the Paris terror attacks, we see the difficulty of something like that and how sort of maybe fantastical it is that we could unwind it. We can't unwind it. I mean, it's been entrenched.
Part of what I'm interested in try to show in the book, which resonates with what you're talking about, is how government really works in practice. It's sort of a study of it. And, you know, one element of that is that I think most people had this sort of very simplistic understanding that, like, Obama is doing this or Bush and Cheney did that. And that's not really how government works. You know, what really happens is there's 100 or 200 people below them who are wrestling with stuff every day that may never reach their attention even. and the day in and day out arguments among those folks that really shape the course of an administration beyond the sort of big picture guideposts set by a president. And of course, he's choosing who those people are. But another is that I think we've seen over and over, and I sort of document this in the couple chapters I have on surveillance in particular, how in the world of counterterrorism, sort of post 9/11 climate, which we're seeing in, you know, goes through problems, but we're in this post Paris moment, it's definitely back to where it was. It's very, once there is a counterterrorism tool in place, whether or not it's effective, whether or not it's legal, whether or not it's a good idea, it's very, very hard for individual judges or lawyers in the government or policymakers or members of Congress to turn that thing off. Because it is one of, you know, even if it's the defenses are imperfect and from time to time something like Paris happens, the next time it that means it's always going to happen again, right? And the next time it happens, if you removed that tool, you will be accused, it'll be of having blood on your hands. It's your fault. We see that already with some of the discussion of, well, we shouldn't, wasn't it insane for Congress in June to pass the USA Freedom Act that's going to change the bulk phone records program, even though, A, that program has never thwarted an attack, it turns out, and B, the change called for by that program hasn't even kicked in yet, won't kick in until the end of November. And it didn't matter in the political sphere, in the campaign sphere, in the sort of press release from congressional offices sphere. Everyone who would, you know, Ted Cruz is being attacked of all people for having voted for it. And so those kind of pressures and anticipating that if you unwind this thing, you'll be blamed the next time something happens, whether or not it had anything to do with that tool that's taken, put it back in the toolbox, is a very, very powerful push in shaping how things happen. And so in the story I tell of the years of internal convulsions and legal contortions and bureaucratic infighting over Bush's Stellar Wind program, which was both the warrantless wiretapping program and the bulk phone records and bulk email records program. You know, he puts it in place unilaterally, lawlessly, and then the intelligence court and the Justice Department, both in the Bush years and then the Obama years as well, are contorting themselves to try to salvage it,
right?
Because no one wants to be the one that turns it off. And so you find judges accepting these really strange interpretations of what words mean and so forth. And they say they're going to turn something off, and then the Justice Department says you're going to have blood on your hands, and they don't do it, over and over and over. You see this pattern. And I think that leads to, once something is in place, that leads to this entrenching factor.
I mean, it's also interesting because it recalls, and I think it was actually the piece that you wrote that garnered the Pulitzer when you were writing about during the Bush administration. And I think at the time, actually, we had spoken at that time, back in my Air America days, you'd written a piece for the Globe on signing statements. And one of the things I distinctly remember in talking to you about it then was this notion of what these signing statements do is they present a sort of a broad sort of, I guess, notion to the bureaucracy that this is going to be met with approval and that won't be, and that this becomes sort of institutionalized, and it creates it's not simply a 50-50 decision by any of these bureaucracies. It weighs the decision in a certain way, and it creates a certain incentive structure. And when you talk about it, obviously the stakes are much different or higher than it would be for, you know, the EPA, I guess, on a specific rule in the context of the national security state. But you're talking about almost like a sort of like this broad adoption of like the 1% doctrine, right? Like you don't want to be the guy holding the hot potato that in some way could be blamed. And I guess just imagine, you know, yourself in some way to be responsible for something horrible to happen. And in some ways, also what you're describing is the way that the Obama administration reacted to the underwire bomber case, that it really put a scare in that administration. Tell us about that case, because that really, it seems to me, according to your reporting, and I want to ask you more about this, but that seems to be a shift in the way that the administration responds to this stuff.
Okay, so just to focus on the last part of what you're asking about, absolutely. So I opened the book with a chapter that reconstructs Christmas Day 2009 from the moment where a Nigerian terrorist on a Detroit-bound airliner goes into the bathroom and prepares on the plane and prepares to blow up a bomb that's hidden in his underwear, which fortunately fails to explode, though does cause a fire, and to the point sort of 12 hours later when he emerges from surgery and the FBI reads him the Miranda warning, which later becomes a political flashpoint, and sort of what that day was like for the people inside the government, especially trying to grapple with it. And then I go off and talk about some big picture themes in chapter 2, and chapter 3 returns to the next day, December 26th, and takes you through to early February 2010, which is that sort of 5 or 6 week period is when everything falls apart, really, for Obama's national security policy. And he has to take an action that's going to destroy his ability to close Guantanamo. He has to pull back, or feel like he has to pull back, the attempt to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other 9/11 defendants from Guantanamo in a regular court in New York, which was the number one symbolic restore the rule of law thing that his administration was doing. And there's this huge political uproar as Republicans who had been on their heels from his 2008 victory and lost a veto-proof majority in the Senate suddenly see him as vulnerable in national security and start attacking him. And in Massachusetts, Scott Brown, a Republican, rides that issue into winning a special election for the Senate seat left vacant when Ted Kennedy died, and which means they don't have a veto-proof majority in the Senate anymore in the middle of healthcare reform. And it really looks like if there is a successful attack again, on their watch, it becomes clear to them they would destroy the presidency and Obama would be a failed one-term president. Everything they were trying to do, whether it was not torture people anymore or not have major occupations in the Middle East or even unrelated things like health insurance, would be reversed by the next president, who would quickly trounce Obama in the next election. And that, so they had already, in the first year, as I document, experienced a lot of turbulence around Guantanamo issues, and they had to make some compromises, but they were basically on track to do what they were trying to do. And that moment, what the reformers inside the administration wanted to do, and that Christmas underwear bombing and the ferocious fallout from it, I portray as sort of Obama's version of 9/11 and how that changed the Bush administration. It profoundly hardened their approach. The voices of reform got quiet. The voices of of caution and security state perspective got louder. And so, we shouldn't send this particular Guantanamo detainee away, or we should not tell the public that we're interpreting the Patriot Act in this way, or we should really hold on to this and do that rather than reform it. Was the approach that was going to prevail going forward. And of course, it's all very complicated, and they still managed to do some things, but I think that was a pivotal moment in understanding this administration's government and they sort of came to grips with the fact that the world was not as they might wish it would be.
And you also in the book talk about the Uyghurs. There were essentially I don't know if they were Chinese nationals, but they were in Guantanamo and they were there totally by mistake. And the inability, or I should say, the blowback from the attempts by the Obama administration to get them out of Guantanamo, and I guess bring them to, and I can't, it escapes me now, I have it in my notes, but to a state, they were pushback, you write that there was such pushback from the local congressman that it also it also sort of really undercut their confidence, and there was a sense in Congress that the Obama administration was underconfident in this area, and they could be cowed in some way.
That's true. So this was the incident where, so this is before the underwear bombing, but it's the sort of first real major turbulence for their agenda. And it's, in some ways, it's the origin story of the failure to close Guantanamo. You're right, there was this group of Chinese Muslims at Guantanamo who had been captured in Afghanistan and brought there. And it turned out that they were not part of Al-Qaeda, and they were not, their enemy was not the United States. If anything, it was Beijing, but they were mostly just people who had fled China and maybe learned to shoot a gun or something while they were in Afghanistan. But a federal judge had ruled that they were not enemy combatants. The executive branch agreed that they shouldn't have been there. And the problem was there was no good place to send them. They couldn't be sent back to China because they would be tortured or worse. And China was using its diplomatic muscle to intimidate other countries into not resettling them. And so there was a plan in the spring of 2009 to bring two of them, the two who spoke English the best, into the United States and let them live under monitoring in Northern Virginia, where I live, where there's a lot of ethnic Uyghurs. There's sort of a community here of that people. And when a local congressman found out about it, he attacked this plan and said this was releasing hardened terrorists into our streets, and it became a thing, not unlike what we're kind of seeing right now with the
Syrian refugees.
You know, the worries about Syrian refugees. And, you know, we had Newt Gingrich linking these to 9/11 and so forth. And the administration, instead of standing up for what it was trying to do, backed down and sort of folded immediately. And then right after that, Congress enacted the first restrictions on transferring Guantanamo detainees, which were unprecedented. The idea of Congress, by statute, regulating what the commander-in-chief in a war could do with wartime prisoners just hadn't been done before. And the Bush would never have stood for it. But the Obama administration didn't want to ruffle these feathers in Congress. They were trying to pass health care reform and Dodd-Frank and all that and deal with financial crisis issues. And it was like one thing too many. So they acquiesced and backed off on bringing these two people here and also signed without complaint those transfer restrictions, which then get tightened and tightened and tightened over time because Congress basically figures out that the administration can be rolled on these issues. And I think in retrospect, a lot of Obama people feel like that was the first place where they really mishandled the situation, leading to the continuing troubles they're having today.
Do you think that was something that was a broader, I don't know, maybe this is too reductive, but character flaw in the administration? Because, I mean, it's not hard, particularly for someone like me, to come up with other examples like that, not in the national security realm, right? Like Shirley Sherrod, they immediately fire her. Or we've seen reporting in those years that they were afraid that Glenn Beck will get a hold of this story or that story. And there was a willingness or a perception by the Obama administration that the way to win is to capitulate in certain areas? Or was it there's something unique about these being national security issues that made them even more sensitive and that had to do less with a character of the administration at that time and had to do something more with an issue that exists between the national security state and presidents or even national security states and maybe Democratic presidents?
Well, I mean, that's a mouthful. Let me focus on just one aspect of it. This is not the, like, are they too quick to capitulate or fire people element. But there's a certain one of the themes I identify in the book and that resonates with the screwing up the Guantanamo policy is a certain slowness, which I tie back to this lawyerliness I was talking about earlier. You know, how are lawyers trained to think? They move carefully. They're deliberate. They really grapple with the other side of whatever the argument is that they're on because they have to go in court and rebut it. They value process, and that's even when they're not dealing directly with a legal issue, that's how they are trained to think about problems and work through problems and think about the world. And so this administration is exceedingly that way, in a way that, say, the Bush administration could be caricatured as the opposite, you know, the cowboy administration that shoots from the hip and just decides things and moves on and don't second-guess themselves. And each of these two mentalities have certain, you know, advantages and dysfunctions when it comes to running a government. So to stay focused on the Obama administration, they really wanted to think through and fully ventilate with all affected agencies everything they're going to do, and really carefully work through all the issues before they changed anything about the status quo. And that kind of, in contrast to the Bush people, who sometimes didn't even tell other parts of the government what was happening until it was already done, famously. And so that kind of a careful, slow, let's have endless meetings about it until we fully, you know, have worked through everything approach can lead to the charges that they're dithering with Dick. You would say, why are they not arming the Syrian rebels already? Why are they not already sending a troop of surge to Afghanistan? Well, they're really thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it and having one more meeting. And so where this, in what we were just talking about, where this plays out is Obama decides he's going to close Guantanamo right after he becomes president. He issues an executive order saying we're going to do it, but then he doesn't do it, right? Instead, he has a long, year-long review process with a six-agency task force to look at each detainee and another task force to look at different options and really think through them. And by the time that those groups are done with their work, the politics have changed dramatically. When Obama was running right. for president, his Republican opponent, John McCain, also wanted to close Guantanamo and said he'd do it on day one. Obama said he was going to do it on day one, but he didn't. And so this policy was sort of sitting out there, and people could start whacking at it like a pinata, especially once they decided he was vulnerable on national security issues, until it was in shreds. And Obama himself has said he thinks one of his mistakes was not just to very quickly say, we're going to close Gitmo, put everyone who's there on a plane and bring them to Leavenworth, and then we'll figure out what to do with them after that. Similarly, they said in November of 2009, we're going to have a regular, civilian, normal, traditional trial for the KSM and the other 9/11 defendants, but then they didn't bring them to New York and just commence things.
Right.
Just let it, they're hanging out there. And so then after the Christmas underwear bombing attack, the political winds shift and people have, you know, the support for it weighs away. But if they had just done what they said they were going to do right away, it wouldn't have mattered because the facts on the ground would have been changed.
The alternate universe where either one of those positions gain more support as time goes on, it simply doesn't exist, it seems to me. But so let me ask you this. The big question, I guess, are there instances that you found in your reporting over these really 6 or 7 years on this specific question of this administration, where the process, in other words, the sort of the legalized process, the deliberative process, the one which sort of ultimately ensured that they were not acting outside the law, even if some others may think that they're acting contrary to civil liberties that we have in this country, did their process ever, could you tell, provide a different outcome than, and it is obviously very difficult to say, but than it would have been had there just been a unitary theory, you know, unitary executive theory process where the president just said, we're just going to do this?
Well, yes. And of course, let me caution by saying I also surface in the book several examples where they didn't live up to their ideals of process, arguably, and things kind of broke down or people weren't told about things that normally would have been. You know, for example, you know, not telling the Justice Department, including the Attorney General and the Office of Legal Counsel, about the work on the plan for the Osama bin Laden operation and so forth. So there are counterexamples, but we're talking about the overall pattern of being very process heavy and normal order and decision making. What we were just talking about, not closing Gitmo, is a great example of what you're asking for. There are a few others. I just mentioned the Osama bin Laden raid. It could very well be that, the first thing they were looking at was not raiding the compound, but bombing it. and which would have solved, been a lot simpler in many ways and less risky in terms of the lives of Navy SEALs and the possibility that they might get captured or shot down inside Pakistani territory, not unlike the 1980 failed attempt to rescue hostages in Iran and so forth. But they moved away from the bombing after a lengthy discussion of legal issues, of collateral damage, and how many civilians in this neighborhood would be killed if they bombed the compound with a sufficient ordnance to take out tunnels that might be underneath it. I don't portray that as just that legal question dictating the outcome, because collateral damage can be lawful in war if it's proportionate to the military objective, and getting bin Laden is a big military objective. But just the focus that the lawyers and the legal question put on that steered the direction eventually to alternatives. And there's a few other examples as well.
And to the extent that there was flaws in their process, even on their terms, right? Where are those things not match up? I mean, you mentioned a couple of these things, and I know that there was a story also of evidence that was acquired through torture where the administration was going to, I guess, release an individual or send them to Europe. And at the last minute, sort of I think it was the CIA basically prevented that from happening, at least at that time. Is there, broadly speaking, some flaws in what they're doing from even on their terms? The idea being that as long as we have a legalistic process for this, then these things, that process will settle it. In other words, and I guess I'm thinking about sort of law that is created at the OLC that we don't see, the Office of Legal Counsel, where Justice Department lawyers sort of interpret the law in some respects. There seems to be some lack of transparency, which undercuts the idea behind that process.
So I guess a couple different things. I mean, I wouldn't say... You're right. One of the things I talk about in the book that hasn't been written about before is a dilemma that arose in 2010 about whether to use evidence that seemed to be tainted by torture to show that evidence to a judge in a habeas corpus case of a Guantanamo detainee to explain why they thought this person was detainable and ought not be released, was too dangerous to release. And it set up this policy dilemma where the State Department and the Justice Department and the intelligence community were all kind of at odds with each other, and one of the three had to lose, and it ended up being the State Department. And it did end up using this arguably tainted evidence. I don't know if I would call that a process failure. It's more like a story that illustrates how even with process, some questions don't have easy answers, and I go into why there wasn't an easy answer in that one. But I'm fast. That's a separate question from what the second part of what you were asking, which was, what about executive branch lawyering? Can you rely on it? Is it really rule of law based, or is it some other animal? And I'm fascinated by this topic, not just with this administration, but with all administrations. When executive branch lawyers are getting together behind closed doors to write secret memos that no one's ever going to see about issues that are never going to get into court, because no one has standing to bring a lawsuit and the people may not even know what's happening. And then they end up citing previous executive branch memos as precedents, because maybe these issues have been dealt with before by previous administrations or similar issues, and that's all there is to look to, because these things never get into court. But then there's overwhelming pressure on executive branch lawyers to find a solution that their policy-making president and people above them that appointed them lets that person do what they want to do or think is necessary to do. And they have to say no if it goes too far. But what does it mean when you have constellations of precedents building up where maybe it doesn't look like it goes too far because it's happened before or something similar to it has happened before, and this sort of accretes over time without ever any outsiders looking at it and saying, this really went off the rails, or yes, we agree. That's a real pressure point in our system. We see with this administration reopening criminal investigation into torture by the CIA and ultimately concluding that no charges could be brought. And a big part of that was that the Justice Department had written secret memos saying that these various torture techniques were lawful. And even though those memos later got withdrawn, because the Justice Department had said it was lawful at the time, the Justice Department could not then prosecute someone for acting in accordance with what the Justice Department had said. And so what's the solution to that? And the various proposals have been bantered about, and they all seem to be sort of unworkable on a pragmatic level, like having a secret internal court of life-tenured people that are confirmed by the Senate. But no one who's worked in government thinks that that actually has any bearing on the reality of how governing works when things are moving very quickly and so forth. The best solution I've been able to come up with is just transparency. And that's sort of part of what my work is, both in this book and in the New York Times as well, is to say, well, you know, to the extent I can, let me surface what the issue was and what legal theories people were coming up with and why it was a dilemma, and try in good faith to explain it. And that provides this the check, because people are going to go back and be law professors or members of law firms, and they want people to think of them as people who obeyed the rule of law and in good faith grappled with these issues and abused their powers.
And I think, you know, I think that is that may be the best we can hope for. And it's definitely something, and you have been really crucial, and this book is really crucial in providing that transparency. Let me just, the last question. When you pose that question to people in who are writing these memos, or to people who are relying on these memos, or around that world, I mean, what do they say? Do they recognize that dilemma, or is it just you get all the answers that you would get if you asked, 10 people, knowledgeable people on the street?
Well, one of the things I asked was the following. So, the Bush administration was not very lawyerly, didn't have all this process, especially in the first term, in the crisis years after 9/11, what lawyers were told what were going on tended to have these very idiosyncratic views of executive power, that a vision of the Constitution where the president can basically do what he thinks is necessary regardless of what a statute or a treaty says. And when that's your view, there's no real reason to grapple with the weeds of the law, because it's always trumped. This administration tried to stay away from that theory. They're very lawyerly. They really wrestled with this stuff. But they often, not always, found a way to do what they were trying to do. And so my question I asked them was the following. What difference does it make at the end of the day if a Bush lawyer writes a two-page memo that says, Commander-in-Chief, so you can do X, and then they go out and get lunch, and the Obama administration takes weeks or months wrestling with this issue and agonizing over it, and they write the 100-page memo that has all the footnotes and addresses all the objections and all the good arguments from the other side about why they might be wrong, and say, well, we couldn't always do X, but in this one case that we're looking at right now, killing this particular U.S. citizen who's a terrorism suspect and can't be captured or whatever, we can do X. And, because at the end of the day, the government is still doing X. So does that really make a difference? And which, one of the great ultimate questions of this era. And so I can tell you at least what some of their arguments were without necessarily endorsing them, which is their argument was, yes, it does make a difference for a couple of different reasons. One is because sometimes the lawyers do say no, sometimes they didn't do X. We talked about a couple of those instances. I found a few more, not many, but some. Secondly, they argued the process to some extent is an end to itself, because really rigorously grappling with it provides assurance that you're doing the right thing at the end. And in some ways, it can shape the direction of the deliberation so that you never get to an X that is unlawful or edgier than it pushes you some other direction. I talked a little bit about the decision not to bomb the Bin Laden compound, but to raid it instead. That might be an example of that. So that's kind of what they say. Is it satisfying? I don't know. But it's certainly the first two post 9/11 presidencies were wildly different, the opposite ends of the scale on this metric of lawyerliness, and yet they in many respects, ended up
the same
with very similar policies, and that is just fascinating, I think. And this book is an effort to grapple with that.
It indeed is. It's The Power Wars by Charlie Savage. We will put a link on majority.fm. Charlie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Shifted in it.